Hey friends, welcome to The Problem with Perfect. What is the problem with perfect? It's the myth that if we just do more, be more, and have more, our lives will be perfect. I'm Robin May, a journalist, wife, mother, and most days, a faith-filled Christian.
And I'm Denise Bickle, a clinical therapist, educator, mom, Mimi, and spirit-filled follower. As recovering perfectionists, we promise to be transparent and real and to share the wisdom of trusted advisors and guests.
So pull up a chair and have a seat. There's always a place for you at our table. Welcome back to another episode of The Problem with Perfect. How's my partner, Denise?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing well myself. It's exciting to have spring finally here, and I'm really enjoying our April series. I kind of thought that last year when we went through this What to Know Before You Go, that I would have figured it all out, but it turns out I just keep learning more and more. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn. There's no doubt about it. And things change even from year to year. So as we've said before, April is National Healthcare Directive Month. And in keeping with our annual series, focusing on what to know before you go, we are discussing issues related to advanced care planning. Dr. Jamie Myers, a hospice and palliative care specialist, joined us to discuss the many myths and misconceptions associated with hospice. And our friend Lauren Eisleben, therapist extraordinaire, joined the podcast to provide valuable insight and resources related to caregiving. We hope you will give those episodes a listen. The wisdom and advice that was shared is invaluable.
Yes. And today's guest is an attorney, which I had to look back. I think it's the first time we've ever had an attorney on the podcast. And we're going to talk about all things estate planning. And so today our guest is Brett Barton. Brett is a licensed attorney in the state of Missouri and Iowa, and he practices solely in the area of estate planning and all that it encompasses. Brett has more than 25 years of experience, and he's a frequent speaker on the topic of Medicaid planning and the protection of assets from nursing home spend down. He's also married, has four children. He has one grandchild and another one on the way, which is crazy to me because, Brett, I don't think you're old enough to have one and one on the way, but good for you. And Brett's hobbies include snow skiing, table tennis, and European board games. So, Brett, thank you so much for your willingness to come on the show, and welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad. So in the context of what to know before you go, I think that on this topic of estate planning, we really have to start out with the why. I think we have to motivate people to keep listening to this episode. And I think that's because people avoid it. They avoid this conversation. Maybe it's because they think it's complicated, or maybe it's because it makes them confront their own mortality, which none of us like to think about. Or maybe it's because they just don't ever get around to having the time for the conversation. So whatever the case, why would you say this conversation about estate planning, including wills and trust, is so important?
Okay, so that's a great way to start. And I would answer that question as to why. The most important why is I do not want people to get stuck. I don't want them to get stuck in a place where there are no solutions. And so oftentimes what happens in an estate planning context is people put off any type of planning until it's too late. And once it's too late, then we really don't have any good options. And so what I want to do is I want to expand the flexibility of the solutions that are available to people. So the sooner that people start the plan, the more options are available. And anytime there are more options, you're going to have better options, better solutions, and with the worst being no solutions, no options, because you're completely stuck. So that is the why. The why is I do not want people to get stuck. I want their goals and objectives to be met both while they're alive and then after they pass away. And so the sooner someone starts doing estate planning, as I said, the more options are available.
Yeah. So could you just give an example of what it looks like to be in that stuck position where you don't have any options?
Absolutely. I can give you an example of someone I met with just last week. I met with a husband and wife, a couple who own assets, and the husband has been showing signs of dementia. And when they came into the office, I asked them if they had any existing estate planning documents in place. And all they told me was they had a will done years ago, back when their children were young, so that they could name guardians for their minor children. And that's all that they had done. And so I began to ask the husband questions to see if I could gauge. And again, I'm not a doctor, I'm a lawyer, so I don't really have a good. I don't have a medical background and can't make a good opinion as to someone's medical situation, but I began asking some questions to determine whether or not I thought he was competent to be able to even execute, sign a legal document saying what he would like to see happen to his stuff. And when I asked him questions, I was not able to tell if he understood my questions and was in a position where he could do that. And once someone reaches a point where they are no longer competent, then there's simply nothing that I can do for a person in that point. The only option available, there is one option available to someone once they are no longer legally competent, and that is to go to court and have a guardian and conservator appointed. And then the court will actually determine what can and cannot be done for that person. And whenever you go to court, you have to get a lawyer involved, and every financial transaction, every decision has to be run by a judge, and the judge has to sign off on it and okay with it, which becomes expensive, it's time consuming, and it's never, ever, ever a good result. So there's a situation where I simply told this couple, hey, you know what? Based upon the fact that the husband no longer has legal competency, at least as best that I can tell, there's simply nothing that I can do.
And no one plans on that, right? No one plans to get to the point where we can't think clearly and make good decisions for ourselves, but it happens.
Well, and before we get too deep into all this, much like the medical profession, I know that the legal profession has lots of terminology that not everybody understands. And I was wondering if you'd kind of go through some of those terms and tell us more about what is the difference between a will and a trust? What is revocable versus irrevocable? Some of those things we hear when we know people are looking into estate planning.
Okay, absolutely. And if I could suggest a word, let me mention the word probate, because I think that's the important place to start. Probate is the legal mechanism that we have in this country, and probate exists in all 50 states here in the United States. It is a legal mechanism that allows for an asset that is owned by a deceased person to be owned by a living person. Okay. For example, let's say I own a car and the car title says it's owned by Brett Barton. That's me. I'm the sole owner of the car. There's no joint owner and there's no beneficiary on it. So I'm the only owner. If I then pass away, if I drop dead right now, who is the owner of my car that says that I am the sole owner of it? I'm now deceased. A lot of times people think, oh, well, surely some things happen automatically. Like, for example, if I'm married, doesn't my wife just own the car? The answer is no, nothing happens automatically because there has to be something that would occur that would allow for some other person to be named as the owner of my car. And the same would be true if I had a bank account at a bank. You know, if a bank finds out I'm deceased, they're not just going to allow for someone to come in there and say, hey, I was married to Brett. You know, is this my account now? They're going to say, well, Brett should have had a beneficiary on this account, or there should have been a joint owner, or we're going to need a court order. And a court order means you have to go to probate court. And so probate is the legal mechanism where you actually go to court and you determine what. were the assets that were owned by the person who is now deceased. And whatever those assets are, then they become a part of the probate estate. And the probate court, the first question they ask, did the deceased person have a last will and testament? If so, let's read the will and see where this person wanted their assets to go. And once the court sees that, they will then issue a court order to the bank, to the DMV, to whatever institution it is that handles the assets that were owned by that deceased person. And that court order will say, okay, that account should now be owned by so-and-so because that's who was named under the will to be the beneficiary of the probate estate. So that's what probate is. And what I tell people, you do not want to have a probate estate because that is a very inefficient way for assets to go from a dead person to a living person. There are lots and lots of better ways to do that. And so, Denise, you mentioned what's the difference between a will and a trust. One of the big differences between a will and a trust is a will only has authority in probate court. So if you're relying on your will to distribute your assets, then you are relying on the probate court to actually make that happen. And what I encourage people to do is I encourage you to do it yourself. Take matters into your own hands and have it become a private matter where you actually go to the bank itself and you say, hey, if I die, I want my account to go to these people, to my kids. Or if I'm married, I want this to be a joint account so that when I die, my spouse is still the owner of it. But then we have TOD or POD beneficiaries so that that account will then flow to my children or grandchildren or whoever it is you want to be inheriting that account. And so that would happen automatically, as opposed to having to hire an attorney, go to probate court, put a notice in the newspaper saying, hey, Brett's passed away. Are there any creditors of his that want to make a claim against the estate? All of that can be avoided simply by making sure the assets are titled in such a way so that there are beneficiaries named on everything. And here in our home state of Missouri, which is, in my opinion, the best state in the whole country for avoiding probate, you can put a beneficiary on absolutely every asset that you own. So regardless of what it is here in Missouri, whether it's your home, whether it's your bank account, whether it's your life insurance policy, your retirement account, your cars, your vehicle, your boat, your trailer, you can put a beneficiary. Even if you have cattle out in your field, you can put beneficiaries on your cattle. Who gets the cattle if you pass away? So Missouri is a great state as far as avoiding probate. Some states, you can't simply name beneficiaries. You might have to take the additional step of creating a trust. And a trust is another way to avoid probate and have it be a private matter. And the trust is a separate legal document that you would have written up all of what your wishes, and then you would actually have your assets be owned in that trust or have the beneficiaries of your assets have your trust named as a beneficiary of the assets so that those assets flow into the trust at a later date.
Right. And not to cut out the middleman by any means, but you know, you can go to Home Depot and get forms that say, you know, trust and you fill it out yourself, or will and you fill it out yourself. Do you recommend those?
I recommend those for people who are willing to do something and not have any customer support if something goes wrong. So I encourage, and this is one of the selling points that I use when I'm recommending my own services. And that is to say that if I'm drafting a legal document for someone, I'm going to stand behind it and I'm going to do whatever it takes for that legal document to be honored and work the way that I say that it will work. And if at any point in time, if something goes wrong, for example, let's say I prepare a power of attorney and someone at the bank has a question about it, I'm going to talk to the people at the bank and I'm going to do that on my own nickel. I'm not going to charge my clients any money to do that because I'm going to stand behind my work. My concern is if you use LegalZoom or buy a form off the internet or at Home Depot, wherever it is you're getting it, if anyone has a question about it, where do you go? Who's going to stand behind those legal documents? And I don't typically think there's anyone there.
Right.
So I usually say you get what you pay for in that respect.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
can see that. Sure.
So I have a question, Brett. So 15 years ago now, my mom passed away. And before she passed away, she and my stepdad, I think thought that everything was in line and in order. It was very clear to me how my mom wanted things to be. And they were very excited that they got all the trust stuff taken care of. So, right in their mind, it's taken care of. It was communicated to me as the co-executor of the trust, what she wanted, what he wanted, and what the expectations would be. So fast forward, my mom's been gone about 12 days, and my stepdad visits an attorney, the same attorney, and changes the trust. And I was pretty blown away by the by that. And it wasn't like changing the trust so that you don't get anything. It wasn't that. It was just changing the trust to be in a way that he felt was going to be easier to manage. But I just, at the time, was just like very confused about how did that happen. So I think it all comes back to my mom probably thought it was an irrevocable trust, but it was revocable. Does that get into that conversation?
It could, and I'm happy to address the issue I think it is you're touching upon here. In essence, whenever a husband and wife create a joint trust, then I think it is the attorney needs to clearly communicate how that trust works while both of the spouses are alive, and then after one of them passes away, and then after both of them pass away. Because one of the significant benefits, in my opinion, of a husband and wife joint trust is having some things become irrevocable when the first spouse dies. For example, let's say we have a husband and wife, and the wife passes away before the husband. Right now, in this country, regardless of what the age is of a surviving husband, there is a 75% likelihood that that man will get remarried. And so it is important that people consider that possibility. Could there be a remarriage situation after the first spouse dies? And does that have any effect on the potential estate planning? Well, when I'm talking to the original couple, most of the time, and I say, hey, do we want to give the surviving spouse the ability to change the beneficiaries? And usually the answer is, well, no. And sometimes there are some extra adjectives thrown in there, like a heck no, no
Yeah.
way. And so that's one of the benefits, in my opinion, of having a trust is that you can create a provision, a rule that says what happens when the first spouse passes away. And the way I typically explain that, and my general recommendation is, we're going to have some things become irrevocable. Now, not everything needs to become irrevocable, but some things do need to get locked in place because we want to protect both spouses' interest in that trust. If you allow for the surviving spouse to change anything and everything about the trust, then what could happen is the children of that initial marriage could be disinherited by some new girlfriend, boyfriend who comes in and sweet talks the surviving spouse into changing their mind on some things. So, Robin, I think that directly addresses your concern there, at least as far as the question you were asking. But if I can step back, typically when we talk about a revocable trust and an irrevocable trust, we usually are addressing how it works at the time when the trust is first created. And so my typical recommendation, even in a husband and wife situation, is for a trust to be revocable and amendable to address any possible things that could arise while both of them are alive. And we want to give them, again, flexibility. We want to leave all the options open. And so I want to give them the flexibility to be able to address, hey, one of my kids' marriages looks really bad. I want to address something in the trust, or one of my grandchildren appears to have a drug or alcohol problem. We want to address that in the trust. So we want to give them the flexibility to be able to modify and change some things. And so that is a revocable trust. An irrevocable trust is a trust that when you set it up, You cannot change it going forward, even if both spouses are still alive and competent and able. And the only reason why you might want to do that, in my opinion, is because you can create an irrevocable trust, put assets into that irrevocable trust, and they are not going to be counted against you for nursing home Medicaid purposes. So it is possible to create an irrevocable trust, put a $1 million farm into that trust, and that farm will be protected for the family, even if the original mom and dad end up in a nursing home. That's one reason why you might want to have an irrevocable trust. But you have to, in essence, you divest yourself of your access to those assets, and you can no longer change the trust after that is done.
Right. So it definitely comes with some risks. Yeah. And then as a part of this whole estate planning conversation, do you talk to folks about their living will and like the power of attorneys, whether it's that or durable power of attorney? Is that part of the conversation that you have with them as well?
Absolutely, it is. In fact, I'm glad you asked that question, because if you hadn't, I would have kind of steered the conversation that way anyway. In my opinion, the absolute most critical legal document that every adult person should have, and when I say adult person, I mean age 18 or older, every adult person, in my opinion, should have a good, durable power of attorney, because it is a power of attorney that really unlocks all of those options. Once you have a good, durable power of attorney in place, then after that, you can become competent, and yet you still can have your wishes carried out. Because that power of attorney, what it does is it appoints somebody else to act in your behalf if you're unable to do something. And it gives that someone else the ability to do just about anything you yourself could do. And so that's why I tell people the starting point in any estate planning conversation is to get a good, durable power of attorney in place. And Robin, let me tell you a quick story, if I may, that to kind of hit home on this. When my son Merrick turned age 18, I told him, I said, hey, you know what? You know, you're now an adult. I no longer have any say over your health care. I have no say over your finances. I effectively have no say over anything. And I said, and if that's what you want, great. But if you'd like for me to prepare a power of attorney that actually gives me that ability to act in your behalf, then you can sign that document. And right after we did that, he and I were out in Colorado. We were actually in Aspen on a ski trip for spring break, and he had an accident while we were skiing, and he had to go to the medical clinic there. And I happened to have a copy of his power of attorney with me, because we actually provide a shrinked down version that you can fit into your wallet of your legal documents. I actually had a copy of his power of attorney that said that I can make decisions for him if he's unable to. And so that way, you know, in case he was actually completely competent and lucid the whole time, so he was fine making his own decisions. But if he was unconscious or unable to make a decision, I actually had the legal paperwork with me right there on the spot, that even though he was 19 and an adult, I could have stepped in and I would have had the legal authority to make decisions for him if need be.
Interesting. Yeah, that I think is probably news to a lot of parents, like myself included, right?
Right. Your kids go off to college and you realize if something goes wrong while they're away, you have no legal authority to make any decision on their behalf. You don't even have a right to their information.
Well, even their medical durable power of attorney. You know, people don't realize that if their child gets in an accident, and I worked in the intensive care unit at the U as part of my internships, and we had a young man there that had just turned 18 and was in an accident. And his parents could not make, and this was a situation where the person was not going to survive their illness or their injuries. And the parents could not make that decision on his behalf because he was 18 years old. However, as things work out sometimes, he had just graduated from Rockbridge in June, May, into May. The accident was in June. And when I asked his parents, you know, does he happen to have an advance directive? I know, you know, maybe probably not. But and they said, Is that like where you write down what you'd want or not want if something? And I said, oh, yes, it is. And they said, you know, he was in some kind of medical class, and the final he had to do a presentation on wills, and he messed up and did a living will, a medical will. And in that document, he said that if something like that ever happened, that he would want to be an organ donor. And just the relief that that brought that family, that they knew they were honoring his wishes. And they didn't have to make that decision. That decision had already been made for them by him. And people, you know, they may still be responsible financially for that hospital bill, but they can't make those kind of decisions unless they've been named as their medical durable power of attorney.
And you mentioned what I was going to say is that's the only thing that parents are guaranteed is to get the bill. Trust me on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Brett, thank you for all of that. I really appreciate that. What I thought was going to be kind of a review for me, but I learned several things and you going through those terms. So thank you for that. So given that, now let's say that you get a new client in your office and they're sitting across from you, they've come to discuss estate planning. I'd just like to know kind of what does that conversation sound like? Where do you start with people who know that they need to do something, but they don't really even know where to start?
Right. So a lot of times people that end up in my office, they say, "Oh, I think I need a will." And usually that's kind of the starting point. And I'll oftentimes, I like to play devil's advocate and I'll say, "Well, why do you think you need a will?" But invariably what happens is I want to get to know what's important to these people, who are the important players in their lives. If they were to pass away, who do they want to get their assets? How do they want to get them? And whether or not they have any concerns about their loved ones that need to be addressed in the estate planning, such as, a shaky marriage, such as maybe a chemical dependency problem, such as not so great with finances. And they're concerned to, hey, what if one of my kids gets $100,000 inheritance? I'm concerned that it'll get blown in a couple of weeks. So those are the types of things that I want to delve into and find out about. And then I want to find out who are the people that are trustworthy individuals who can make decisions on these people, on their behalf if they're not able to do so. And so then once I kind of get an idea of that, then what I do, I make a recommendation. I say, hey, here's what I think you need. If you would like for me to help you get there, this is what I would charge. And I always, quote a fixed fee, a flat fee, and say, hey, I'm going to charge you whether it's $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000, depending on what's all involved. And then they can take it or leave it. They can either say yay, nay, or I'll think about it, and which usually means I'll never hear from them again. But yeah, that's the way I normally handle a meeting like that. And then if there are specific questions they have for me, we handle those as well. But that's kind of the long and short of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's really helpful. And I know I'll just say I think a lot of people are scared to see an attorney because of the recurring fees. So I think just the fact that you were transparent about this is what it's going to cost you. You know up front, and it's not one of those things that people can be, I mean, they might be surprised by the initial meeting, but what I hear you saying is they're not going to be surprised every month when they get a bill that's extra on top of what we had discussed.
Yeah, that's the way we do things here at my office. And that initial meeting is at no charge. So I offer a free consultation and then I make the fee quote. And now, when you say reoccurring charges, I do encourage people to revisit their estate planning from time to time, because, 5, 10 years go by, there might be changes in their fi family circumstances or in the makeup of their assets that need to be addressed. And so we do encourage our clients to have their estate plans reviewed every 5 to 10 years. And we typically do charge a fee to do that if we do a review and there might be some update work. But for the most part, again, it's, hey, I'm going to quote a fixed fee. This is what it's going to cost to do this. And it's either a yes or no from there.
Well, I think that that's important because if people are listening to this podcast, maybe they want to come visit you and that's great, but maybe they live in Colorado and they're probably not going to visit you, right? Because you're not licensed in Colorado, but they know that there are fee structures where you can know the cost up front, right? And so to find an attorney that fits what you're looking for.
Yeah, I think for most estate planning attorneys around the country, They usually have a similar model in the way they
Okay.
handle things. Yes.
Good to know. Good to know. I want to ask you, does everyone need a trust? Because I'm looking back at what your definitions were for like a will. And so what I heard you say is like if you're in Missouri and you want to make sure that every single asset you have has some transfer upon death or some beneficiary, then maybe you don't need a will. Or so just can you clear that up? Like who needs a will and who needs a trust? And really I'm asking for a friend.
Okay, that's a great question, Robin. And this is somewhat state dependent,
Okay.
because again, when you introduced me, you mentioned the fact that I'm licensed in both Missouri and Iowa, and depending on whether I'm talking to someone in Missouri and Iowa, I'm going to give a different answer to that question. First of all, does everyone need a will? My answer is no, I don't know if anyone necessarily needs a will, because first of all, there are default provisions within the law that says, hey, if a person dies without a will, this is where their assets go. And oftentimes that is similar to exactly what someone would want to have anyway. But the other thing is, remember when I was talking about probate, which is the only place a will has any authority, is probate is only going to handle assets that do not have a joint owner on it and do not have beneficiaries. You know, when I talk to people, most people, when they tell me what assets they have, I'll say, hey, do you have any life insurance? And they'll say, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And I'll say, do you have beneficiaries on that life insurance? Well, sure, the insurance company require that I put beneficiaries on there. So it doesn't matter what your will says as to that life insurance policy, because the insurance company says, hey, according to the policy, here's who we're going to write the check to when you pass away. We don't care what your will says. So, a will has no say over any assets that have beneficiaries named, which is going to be true for your retirement accounts. If you have an IRA or 401k or 457, 403b, more than likely you've already got beneficiaries named on there. Now, here in Missouri, you do not need a trust to avoid probate because, as I mentioned earlier, you can put a beneficiary on everything that you own here in Missouri. In Iowa, you cannot put a beneficiary on everything that you own, such as your home, any real estate that you have. You actually need a trust if you want to avoid the probate process in Iowa. And I encourage all of my clients to absolutely avoid the probate process if at all possible. So, depending on where you are and what your state rules are as it relates to probate avoidance and whether or not you can put beneficiaries on something are going to be the driving factor in whether or not you need a trust. Now, just because you don't need a trust here in Missouri, there might be, to avoid probate, there might be other good reasons why you might want to have a trust. And so oftentimes I will say, hey, do you want to have a trust that becomes irrevocable when the first spouse dies to ensure that your kids get everything? Do you want to protect your kids' inheritance from claims of their creditors, from a potential divorce, potential lawsuit? All of those types of questions. That's where if people say, oh my gosh, yes, we definitely want that benefit in our estate plan. And at that point in time, I'm going to say, okay, then a trust would probably be the way to go.
Interesting. Interesting. Does that conversation sound different if it's a single person?
It does. It does sound different because a single person isn't worried about their spouse changing everything up or getting remarried. So, a single person, in my opinion, especially here in Missouri, is less likely to need a trust.
Interesting. Yeah. Did you know that, Denise? Single
Yeah,
person?
I think I did, but I wasn't sure about Colorado. That's something I should be asking someone. What happens if someone can't afford an attorney? What's the next best thing for them to be able to make some of these decisions and make sure that some of these issues are handled appropriately?
Okay, well, that's a good question. It's funny because in estate planning, most of the clients that I'm working with have more money than I do. And so I really have no problems, no concerns or worries about how are they going to pay and afford an attorney because typically they have assets, and the reason they're talking to me is they have a lot of assets and they want to protect as much as they possibly can. Now, I do a lot of nursing home or Medicaid planning for folks, and those folks may not have much in the way of assets. And so oftentimes, if I meet with someone and there really aren't any assets, but I think there's something, if I feel like they need a lawyer to help them, then I take pro bono cases all the time in situations like that, where I'm not going to charge a fee. I'm going to do whatever legal work needs to be done for them. And in which case, there should never, ever be a situation where someone can't afford an attorney, because either they can afford an attorney or that attorney should be willing to do pro bono work for them. At least that's my view on it.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear.
It is. Your parents taught you right. Oh, wait, your dad's next door, right?
Well, you know what? Even the State Law Ethics Commission requires that that lawyers provide a certain number of pro bono hours every year. So it's something we're encouraged to do, regardless of the way our parents raised us.
Good to know. I did not know that. So really, it is good to know. All right. Well, speaking of money, I was a little surprised when I looked at your website because I know what you do, and I know that you typically everyone that I know that says that they visited you professionally has a lot of assets, right? And so I was interested when I was looking on your website about the different seminars that you do, and that one was on Medicaid. And since Medicaid is traditionally for people with fewer or no assets, I explain to me why this demographic is one that you're really invested in.
Okay, so my dad started this law firm in the mid 70s, and he started focusing the services that this law firm provides on estate planning probably in the mid 80s. And so when he started drafting trusts for people back then, most of the people were setting up trusts because they had tax issues. We had very, very small estate tax exemptions. And so it didn't take a very big estate to run into an estate tax issue. And a trust can help minimize estate taxes. Well, as those clients got older, all of a sudden they were less concerned about taxes and more concerned about the high cost of a nursing home if one of the spouses should end up in a nursing home. So we actually saw where we thought all of the problems were going to be tax related, but over time they shifted to, oh no, there are other issues, there are other problems out there. And so that's when I started looking into, okay, what does the law allow for people to do in the way of nursing home planning? And can someone that has assets be eligible for Medicaid to help pay the nursing home cost? And lo and behold, what I found once I started looking into it is that yes, even people with assets can protect those assets and still become eligible for Medicaid. And so my job as an attorney is not to determine whether or not someone with $1 million should become eligible for Medicaid. My job as an attorney is to inform my clients of what the law allows for them to do. And then they make that decision whether or not they want to pursue protecting their assets from nursing home spend down. And so I give talks at nursing homes, at banks, any opportunity I have to speak to the public. I want to inform people about what the law allows for people to do, because this is an area where most people know just a little bit, but they only have a small piece of the puzzle. And so what I try to do is I try to inject more information into the public to let people know what can and can't be done, what and where the common mistakes are. And there are common mistakes that are made when it comes to nursing home planning.
Yeah, we've had other episodes on this in the series about like the care and hospice and nursing homes and other things. So yeah, it's an important piece of this What to Know Before You Go series.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I found one other thing on your website I thought that was interesting. You said, find out why traditional estate planning doesn't work and find out what does. And so I just thought, now that we have kind of an idea of all these terms, what would you consider traditional estate planning, and what is the better alternative?
So traditional estate planning would be using a last will and testament to handle the distribution of assets when someone passes away. And I would say that is absolutely obsolete, in that that is a very poor, inefficient way of handling your assets upon death. And oftentimes, what ends up happening is most of the time, again, people set up a will and they think, oh, my will says that, this asset goes here and this asset goes here. And then what happens when the person ultimately passes away? It turns out that, oh, you know what? That particular asset that was supposed to go to son Johnny, we actually put daughter Mary on as a joint owner on that account because she was helping write checks for the parents before they passed away. So guess what? That's now Mary's account because she was a joint owner. She's still alive. The will has no say over that. And so ultimately what happens is there's this mishmash of things that goes on that people just aren't aware of because they haven't taken a comprehensive look at everything. And oftentimes they just thought, oh, hey, if I have some generic provisions in the will, that will win the day, when usually it doesn't. Usually it doesn't have any say over what ultimately happens. And so that's what I would say traditional estate planning is relying on a last will and testament when there's certainly better options out there. TOD, POD, at least here in Missouri, beneficiary deeds here in Missouri, a revocable living trust in any state is a preferable way to go than using a will.
Yeah. So as we're wrapping up, what haven't we asked that you want us to know?
Well, Denise, we've actually covered a lot of ground, I think,
Yes, we have.
for a meeting such as this. So, goodness, I don't know if there's anything that necessarily comes to mind.
I have one.
Okay, go ahead, Robin. What do you got?
Well, several times you made a point of saying a good power of attorney, a good power of attorney. And somewhere on this desk, there's some legal work that I received from, it's a long story, but it is at the heart of it is a dispute over whether or not it was a good power of attorney. So can you define for us what you think is a good power of attorney?
Robin, I am so impressed that you heard me say that. And yes, I did stress that because so much of what I end up doing here in my office is updating other lawyers' work because I either think it's substandard or just not a good fit for the people who have that type of planning. So, and again, the other thing that I mentioned, not just a good durable power of attorney, but the power of attorney is the most critical part of the estate plan, because a good durable power of attorney is going to allow for the agent, who is the other person named, to act on the principal party's behalf. A good durable power of attorney is going to give that agent the ability to create a trust if necessary, to change beneficiary designations if necessary, to give assets away or to move assets around from one account to another, all of which we might want to have happen depending on what the situation is. And so, again, I want the maximum amount of flexibility. I want all the solutions available. And so, what differentiates a good durable power of attorney from a not so good power of attorney is, does the agent have the ability to do just about everything? And if there are things that are lacking, if there are things that are missing, then in my opinion, it's not a good durable power of attorney. For example, one of the things that I always look for, does the agent under the power of attorney have the ability to give stuff away? Under Missouri law, if the power of attorney is silent, or if it just has a blanket clause that says, hey, I give my agent the ability to do everything on my behalf, that's not good enough for certain powers. The ability to make gifts has to be specifically stated under Missouri state law in order for the agent to be able to do that. And oftentimes that might be something that I recommend. Or I can tell you a very common situation. Let's say someone goes to church and is a frequent tither to their church. And so let's say they give $100 to their church every month. And if that person loses capacity, and then the agent under a power of attorney has to step in, the only way that agent can continue to make charitable gifts is if the power of attorney allows for that person to do it. Otherwise, they can no longer make any types of gifts, even if that person has been going to that church for their whole entire life. And so we want to make sure that the agent, the other person, can do everything that the original person could do. And in my opinion, the only reason why you might not want to do that, why would you not want to give the agent some of these very, very powerful powers? The only reason why you might not want to do that is if you don't completely trust them.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
Like, oh my gosh, you're giving this other person so many powerful powers over your stuff. Why would you do that? Well, the reason why you would do it is because you do trust them. You trust them implicitly. And if you have any reservations whatsoever, by golly, do not name them as the agent under your power of attorney. But if you do trust them, then give them all of the powers that they might need to be able to manage your affairs and do whatever might need to be done.
And therein lies why some people, I would assume, change their power of attorney.
Exactly. Because it's possible that someone who they trusted at one point proves to be untrustworthy. And at that point in time, yes, you would need to change your power of attorney.
Yeah.
There's where it gets sticky.
Golly. And having worked in hospice, I can say that I have seen some families really struggle with possessions and who gets mom's china and who gets the diamond wedding ring. And if you can have all that established so that families can just go about the work of grieving and not have to be involved in all of these other minutiae, materialistic issues that can sometimes really drive a family apart. And that's such a sad thing when it happens. And so I'm glad you're there, Brett. I'm glad that you're helping people pro bono and charging for your services, because it sounds like they certainly are well worth the time and money spent. And I found a quote that I really liked, and I think it's a good way to just remind people. It says, as long as you understand that you find happiness through family, friends, and love, then money is just a nice bonus.
So true. So true. Brett, we're going to link your information in the show notes so anyone that wants to find you can find you. But thank you so much. Our time with you has been so enlightening and delightful. I would expect nonetheless, but thank
I
you.
I made notes.
I made lots of notes. Yes. And I will be talking to Mr. Tom May about all these notes, because we have some room for improvement. So thank you, Brett.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. We're honored you're sharing your day with us.
Do you love a good book? So do we. So join us for the Problem with Perfect Book Club. If you'd like more information about what we're reading this month and how to join us for the virtual discussion, please email us at theproblemwithperfect@gmail.com. Or if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss on the podcast, use that same email, theproblemwithperfect@gmail.com, to send us your ideas or feedback. We love hearing from you.
And if this episode has been helpful, please share it with a friend or a family member who might find it encouraging. Secondly, we would love for you to leave a review on Apple or on Spotify. It's only going to take you a few minutes, but it will really help our podcast grow. And while you're there, make sure you've subscribed to the podcast so you never miss an episode.
As always, a special shout out to our editor, Jordan Overkamp, for making us sparkle.
And remember, there's always enough grace for you today, so be sure to give it to yourself.